Impairment?
Yeah.
Please.
To the next agenda, impairment.
We have four staff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, please.
Please.
Okay. Next agenda is impairment, the most crucial, difficult subject. Agenda paper is three. We have four issues actually in this paper. Please take a look at paragraph six. However, because of time constraint, we may not be able to cover issues three and four. So those may be discussed at the staff meeting tomorrow. So let's go to issue one and two. Those are actually relating to the observations coming from FSB's outreaches. The first one is as to whether this impairment model should be a single measurement objective, as now FSB is proposing only by having a lifetime loss model, or versus a dual measurement objective. This is tentatively decided by ISB, 12 months plus lifetime losses. The second issue is more operational concerns expressed by FSB side, especially for the transfer notion under the three bucket model. But we'd like to propose somehow, some constructive or positive comment how to improve for this operational issues and issue two. So let's start with issue one. Kamiya-san, please explain.
Issue one is about the measurement objective of for impairment model. The reason why we raise this issue is that, as mentioned in paragraph 8, one of the concerns by the U.S. stakeholders about three-bucket model is the use of dual measurement. Therefore, for the purpose of discussion about single measurement objective and dual measurement objective, pros and cons both for both are summarized in paragraphs 10 to 26. As described in paragraph 13, from the viewpoint of the understandability about the balance sheet information, single measurement objective would have an advantage. On the other hand, our concerns about the single measurement objective are about significant day one loss issues and the understandability of income statement information, which is described in paragraphs 16 to 19. As described in paragraph 27, basically we want to analyze the FASB's CCL model more in detail after the FASB provides more detailed explanation about the model. Which is based on a dual measurement objective. Sorry. However, at this point, the ESBJ staff thinks that the impairment model, which is based on a dual measurement objective, would be more appropriate because it better reflects the economics of the entity's lending activities and its credit risk management. In paragraphs 30 to 34, we discussed 12 months expected losses recognition for bucket 1. Our understanding is that currently in practice, Japanese banks and banks in other countries have a different emergence period for recognizing impairment for performing loans. On this point, we think it will be difficult to ignore the harmonization between the accounting requirements in the board's impairment project and each country's regulatory requirements, although it may not be conceptually appropriate. In addition, as mentioned in paragraph 31, we are not in the position to evaluate U.S. stakeholders' argument that the three-bucket model would result in lower allowance balance than existing standards. We think in order to assess the three-bucket model as a whole from the viewpoint of the sufficiency of the entire allowance balance, in addition to emergence period, other factors such as the timing of capturing bucket 2 or 3 assets should be more closely analyzed. On this point, as described in paragraph 34, we think that recognizing 12 months expected losses would reflect to a certain extent the relationship between the expected losses for each period and interest revenue, which would compensate such losses. Discussion point 1, what do you think about the SBJ staff analysis on which impairment measurement objective is more appropriate?
Manuel?
Yeah, thanks for that. I'll just start with, I guess, this single measurement objective versus the dual measurement objective. Under the ISB's initial exposure draft, there was a single measurement objective as well. However, I guess the difference between that measurement objective and the FASB measurement objective is the measurement and specifically the discount rates. Both of those requirements still look at expected losses. However, the original exposure draft used a credit-adjusted interest rate, whereas the FASB is using the effective interest rate in accordance with the measurement of the assets at amortized cost. Now, I think conceptually you need to use the credit-adjusted effective interest rate, which was according to the board's original ED. However, because of the difficulties of applying that approach, entities wanted to use the original effective interest rate in order to do the measurement. Now, in order to address those concerns but still maintain the relationship between interest income and the allowance amounts, the board decided to keep the to measure the expected losses using that effective interest rate, but to change the recognition. So you recognize a portion up front and a portion later on. Now, in order to get that relationship right, the board has had to think about how much to recognize up front and when the timing of the recognition of lifetime expected losses should be. So there's a relationship between the amount that is recognized up front and the timing of recognition for the full lifetime amount. And I think that's reflected in some of the analysis here in order to maintain that link between the allowance and the interest rate. Is there a conceptual justification for the 12-month expected loss? There probably isn't a reason specifically why that time horizon has been selected. However, it does reflect the fact that the timing of recognition of the lifetime expected loss will be significantly earlier than under the current requirements. So it is more a question of achieving a balance between how much to recognize up front and how early the recognition of lifetime expected losses should be. So there needs to be an appropriate balance between those two aspects. Obviously, the later that the lifetime expected loss would be recognized, then to maintain that balance, a longer or a larger portion of those lifetime expected losses will be recognized up front. There is still going to be the issue of, because we've moved away from the single measurement objective in the original ED, both the model that the board is considering at the moment and the model that the FASB considering is both have initial recognition of expected losses. The difference is the amount. If you recognize the full expected losses at the original effective interest rate, you end up with the double counting of those initial expected losses, which the board was trying to avoid. And I think that basically sums up what the thinking behind the initial single measurement objective and why the board's moved to the dual measurement objective. And I think that's been reflected in the analysis, yes.
Alex?
Stephen?
I think your paper illustrates very well the sort of difficulties in this area. And you start off talking about the advantages of a single model, single measurement approach. And it is very attractive in many respects because you avoid the line and having to do the transfer. It also means that any change in credit quality is immediately reflected in the income statement. In paragraph 15, you sort of make that observation, which any transfer approach is going to compromise because you will have some situations where an asset remains in the 12-month allowance even though it's deteriorated. So there's a limited reflection of that deterioration only, not a full reflection of the deterioration. In other situations where an asset does transfer from 12-month allowance to the lifetime allowance, arguably the impact on the profit and loss is greater than the actual extent of the deterioration because you flip from 12 months to lifetime, even though the deterioration itself may have only added a relatively small amount to that lifetime loss. So all of these are sort of extremely attractive aspects of the FASB model and CECL, whatever they want to call it. But your observation in paragraph 17 is the key one, which is why the board, the ISB, hasn't, in the end, decided that this is the appropriate approach. Because, as you observe, recognizing full expected lifetime losses in all cases, it ignores the compensation in terms of future interest income. So you end up with, and the problem that you identified, which is the day one loss, and it just doesn't seem to reflect the economics of the transaction. And as Manuel was observing about our original ED, we had a very different focus. So the FASB approach in measuring the lifetime loss is the present value of the cash that you don't expect to collect, whereas in our original ED, we turn it around the other way. It was the present value of the cash you do expect to collect, which, of course, is much more consistent with how we deal with impairment in other areas of accounting. So if we're measuring impairment of a non-financial asset, we focus upon the cash inflows and the discounting of those cash inflows, and if the result of that is less than the carrying value, we write it down. And it seems very odd to me to focus purely on the cash you don't expect to collect as a basis for the impairment. And that, I think, is what creates the very odd answer that the FASB is ending up with. But my question for you is, when you mention about compensated by future interest revenue, have you ever thought perhaps about whether one could incorporate that future expected interest revenue in the measurement of the impairment? I mean, if we could measure impairment as present value of the cash you don't expect to collect minus, deduct the extra cash you do expect as a result of that interest income, looking at the compensation effect, maybe you could get to a lifetime loss measure that was more useful, more appropriate, focusing not on, not just on the contractual cash which you don't expect, but also this interest income that you hope to collect to compensate for that. Had you ever thought about that as a, as an approach?
Yeah, personally, I think the reason why I wrote this paragraph is that I was struggling to conceptually justify the 12 months expected losses recognition for performing loans because of the recognizing 12 months loss would lead to some kind of day one loss issues again. So I'm not supportive of the compensation notion in the bucket one from the viewpoint of conceptual viewpoint, but this type of notion could partly support the 12 months losses for recognition for bucket one. So
I agree that one could rationalize the 12-month bucket one allowance on that basis, although it's not a very pure approach to it. It's not arbitrary, but there isn't you're not necessarily matching up the period of the interest. It's a simplification. I was more referring to the measurement of a lifetime allowance and whether one could amends the measurement of a lifetime allowance to reflect reflect the point you were making in paragraph 17, to reflect the interest income that you expect to collect. That was more what I was sort of thinking about. But clearly there are operational concerns in all of these different measures. But I think you've identified the sort of the key reason why the ISB hasn't.
Clarifying. Yeah, to me.
Actually, I have not analyzed the what you have mentioned in detail. From the viewpoint of the operational reasons and the impairment recognition is a very subjective area. Different entities might estimate full-time, so-called full-time expected losses in very different way. I'm not involved in the this area deeply so far.
On that point, I think in terms of the measurement and how it's performed, what information would be taken into account. I think the FASB model and the ISB model are quite similar in the measurement of expected losses is inherently subjective. So entities are obviously going to be limited to the information they have and what they can derive. And obviously there's going to be differences depending on the level of sophistication that an entity does their measurement.
Yes, I'm afraid we agree here. We can spin this discussion out.
Okay. Secondly, it's also related to somehow this, single measurement or dual measurement objective, so that let's go to the issue two. Operational concerns about the three bucket model, especially transfer notion. Kamiya-san, will you explain?
Issue two is about the why, how to alleviate the operational constraints of the three bucket model. The section from paragraph 38 to 49 is SVJ staff's analysis, which is focusing on two criteria for transfer among buckets. In paragraph 38 to 44, we discussed more than an insignificant deterioration criteria. This issue was also discussed in the previous ISB SVJ meeting in April. As described in paragraph 41, in general, most drones are originated at the level of boot quality. Therefore, we think in the context of a three-bucket model, in many cases, by only using a reasonably possible criterion, an entity could capture bucket two or three types of loans. Accordingly, as described in paragraph 43, we think that the term more than insignificant deterioration could be specified as an indicator for rebutting when a loan meets criterion reasonably possible. We think that our proposal in paragraph 43 may not sufficiently address the U.S. stakeholders' concern, but by doing so, we could address the issue of the broader interpretations about the transfer notion to a certain extent. And about a reasonably possible criterion, as described in paragraph 46, we think basically an entity should define the credit quality for reasonably possible to default according to its internal credit grade. This treatment would not ensure comparability among entities, but the three-bucket model has been developed based on the entity's credit risk management, so we think it would be challenging to define the specific line like 5% PD for reasonably possible in the accounting standards in order to ensure such comparability. As mentioned in paragraph 49, it will be important to disclose the information how an entity determine the line as reasonably possible, like the information about how an entity maps its internal credit ratings to a reasonably possible criterion in the three-bucket model. Discussion point two, what do you think about the SVJ staff's analysis on how to alleviate the operational concerns about three bucket model?
Manuel?
I'd just like to say I think this is quite timely, and thank you for the input, because we are going to be considering clarifying the criteria at the next board meeting. Just a few thoughts. I think a lot of this captures what our thinking is in alleviating some of the operational concerns of applying the criteria, which is going to be tough. But just I wanted to make a point about the risk management. I think ideally if the criteria reflects some kind of economic concept, it should be able to tie in risk management. However, that's presuming that the risk management also reflects the economics, and obviously different entities will have different risk management practices, and we don't want to advantage ones with poor risk management and disadvantage ones with really good risk management. So we need to find an appropriate balance there. In terms of operationalizing the criteria, we have talked to a few banks and about this, the difficulty with the relative criteria and the tracking problems that might arise in terms of the comparison required between the initial credit quality and the credit quality at the balance date, and some of them have noted that if they do originate at a particular level of credit quality, that those costs are reduced because they can just assess it based on the absolute criteria, and depending on where it is at balance sheet date, they can make just the assumption that the relative criteria is met. And I think you've also captured the challenge we face in finding the right balance between the relative and the absolute criteria. In some respect, I guess this notion of having a single criteria might be applicable, for example, the 5%, which has been suggested to us by some banks during our outreach, in terms of using that as a relative criteria, we will just need a single criterion because assets that are originated at risk below that level would automatically have to meet that. So it would serve as a useful point. However, there would be no conceptual reason why we choose 5% or another percentage in terms of PD. And I think in terms of the thinking, which is consistent with what you have here, the balance that we're trying to achieve is, as we mentioned before, with the dual measurements approach, the timing of recognition is quite important in reflecting the economics. Obviously, if we recognize the lifetime loss too early, we almost end up at the FASB model. If we recognize it too late, we end up at the current incurred loss model. So we're really trying to find this magic line in between, which is very difficult, but I think this is quite useful input, yes.
Thank you. I think I'll just add a couple of things. I think the comments, the observations you make on the more than insignificant deterioration and the fact that that criterion in itself can be the only thing that you need to look at, we'd absolutely agree with that, which is why we had the two criteria there. For some loans where you originate them at high quality, you know just by where their credit quality is now that the criteria have been satisfied. So we'd agree with that. Where it's more difficult is if you've originated loans that are below that reasonably possible criteria, determining when to move those, change their measurement objective. And on the reasonably possible criterion, the types of things that you're looking at here in terms of would you originate at this level, would you originate at this price is something we're thinking about. What's your internal grading category? Have you changed the internal grading? This is exactly the type of information that we're looking at to bring in this November board paper to talk to the board about ways that we can operationalise it. And I think one of the challenges that you acknowledge in here is how do we get comparability between entities when they're managing risks differently? And I think as staff at least, we probably think that we need to accept some differences between entities because they manage differently and they do have different information. As long as the concepts are clear, we should have consistency of application, but they're never going to be directly comparable just because the assets management systems are different. But as long as we have adequate disclosures about how they've made the assessments, I think that's fine. And even today, under the incurred loss model, even though it seems like a clear concept, we know that application's not comparable anyway. So it's not as though we're moving from a, you know, very certain environment to a less certain environment in that sense.
That's just what I was going to say. I think comparability is a huge issue right now in terms of what banks are really doing with the incurred loss model, because if you want to interpret it liberally and take your losses sooner rather than later, I think there is scope for that. And obviously the standard, I think the biggest problem of the standard is that it gives a lot of legitimation for taking losses as late as possible, even though you already know that you are in serious problems.
I'd like to ask, when you say 5% PDs, does that mean 1 year PD or full-time PD? I mean, so the reason why I don't support such idea is it is difficult to define the emergence period for PD.
Yes, we are thinking about the term structure as well of the credit risk, and obviously I think we need to clarify whether the criterion reflects the term structure as well and how that would be determined. So in terms of the 5%, I think the banks that were suggesting that were thinking 1 year PD. And I think if you do consider the term structure, then you could reduce the comparison to a 12-month PD because a shift there would mean that the term structure has shifted. However, with the danger in using the 5% PD would mean that it implies a statistical type of comparison, and not all banks or not all entities would be able to do that. So we need to somehow convert that into a qualitative assessment as well. And we have been looking at the words used by the rating agencies in terms of defining that level of risk. And we have looked at the suggestion, some of these suggestions here, that you have approach A and approach B, such as whether investment grade is a suitable level. And I just wanted to mention something that Sue touched on in terms of comparability. We've also heard that even within an entity, credit risk management differs between different asset types. For example, the retail portfolios. And because of the lack of information or the limits on the information available for loans in retail portfolios, we need to be able to have an approach that would apply to them as well, and recognize that the limits on the information in those portfolios, the subjectivity inherent in assessing the credit risk with those limitations will be different to for example, the bonds and debt securities.
Equal?
Started talking with Megabank first. So they usually have the pretty good grading system, such as 10-point grading. So they believe the absolute approach is enough, and two different criteria it's too much complex for them. I feel the sympathy for them, considering what the impairment estimate is. It's a little bit similar with fair value estimate. It is limited to the credit risk. It may be easier and simpler, but when you make mark to model, so you don't think about the change to the current period. You just think about the current and the future. The similar thing happens to the estimate of impairment. You think about the future cash flow estimate. So considering those, if the system is well established, I think absolute approach may be sufficient. But at this point, I shouldn't say eliminating more than insignificant deterioration, but a mixture of those two is, I guess, it is very difficult.
I think probably in operationalizing this approach, we will put more emphasis on the absolute side of it. But I'm not sure that we can completely lose sight of the deterioration concept.
I think in terms of the way the model has been set up, because it's a deterioration model, the initial reference point is the credit quality on initial recognition and how far the quality has deteriorated, as opposed to the incurred loss model, which looks at how close it is to default.
It's a link with price, and
it comes back to the link with pricing and finding the appropriate balance, as you mentioned, between the relative and the absolute. However, if the board decides that the amount of the relative change is greater than the absolute criteria, then, for instance, the 5% PD, then the absolute criteria becomes redundant. You no longer need that because an investment grade asset would have to deteriorate 5% in order to meet that anyway, and that reduces to a single criteria. But then if you originate beyond that, then you would have to track those loans or have some understanding of, for instance, in a portfolio, whether you're originating at credit quality level below investment grade. If you're doing that quite often, then it alleviates some of the operational concerns because you could just set an absolute criteria, say, at 10%, and for those ones that you originate above 5%, you just and you're doing that consistently across a portfolio, you can just recognize lifetime losses when they go above 10%. The difficulty, I guess, and it was mentioned in another part of your paper, is if you do the assessment based on the borrower and not on the individual loan, where you mentioned in a later part of your paper, the loan by loan. So if you have a borrower who started off with as quite good credit quality, he's deteriorated, what that loan has gone into lifetime loss, but you originate a new loan, and under the model that would require 12-month expected loss, and it may sound counterintuitive, but as we mentioned, we do want to reflect that the subsequent loan would probably have a higher interest rate to reflect that higher quality as well. So it's a balance between operationalizing the model and achieving the objectives that the board wants to achieve in terms of reflecting the relationship with the interest charged on that loan. So quite difficult, but we hope we'll get the right balance. Yeah.
Yes, one of difficulties in operation for this three-packet model, especially for the transfer notion, is as explained in paragraph 35, transfer notion is based on the two conditions. One is there is a more than insignificant deterioration in the credit quality. B is the likelihood of default is such it's at least reasonably possible. As explained in our paper, paragraph 42, 43, 44, those two conditions are equal prominence. However, in practice, if we determine B is met, A would be automatically met, so that in order to avoid the complication or criticizes for difficult to understand, A should be considered as just an indicator rather than equal prominence with B. That is our staff, is talking about. What do you think of that idea?
I think the difficulty with limiting the criteria to the absolute criteria is we risk losing the link between the pricing and the allowance, which is one of the reasons, one of the objectives of the board to reflect that relationship. And if a loan is originated at a quality below the absolute criteria, if we recognize lifetime losses on that loan, it would be understating the value of the assets. I mean, it would be reverting back to the FASB model for those assets. As I mentioned earlier, it might be more in line with the board's objective I think the objective of a single criteria is quite good. However, the question is whether that should be absolute or relative. and perhaps a single relative criterion that was sufficient enough, so deterioration needed to be meaningful or significant. Yeah. I think that would help in a way in terms of most of the good quality assets would have to deteriorate quite a bit for that criteria to be met. However, for the low quality assets, an entity would still need to determine whether that relative criteria would be met. And I think that's probably, my personal preference of better meeting the objectives of the board, however limiting it to the single criteria as you suggest.
Yeah. I think that one other scenario that we'll ask the board about in the November meeting, which would effectively be merging the two criteria, is in the context of things like retail portfolios. If the only information somebody has is delinquency information and that's how they manage credit, then by knowing that something's past due, you'd be able to effectively satisfy both the criteria, so you don't need to look separately at the credit quality and the deterioration. Both things would be met by looking at delinquency information. So I think in some ways for different types of portfolios, in effect, the two criteria will be merged, which will make it easier to operationalise for some subsets of the portfolios if the board agrees with that assessment.
Attention in the amendment of reasonable the more than insignificant criterion is describing paragraph 44. That is to capture the meaningful credit deterioration because the one thing I noticed from the feedback from the constituents is that some of them are thinking that the more than significant criteria is capturing any credit deterioration. So in order to avoid such misunderstanding, that notion might be helpful, I think.
Okay. Shall we move to the next question?
Okay, so let me move on to the issue 2-1. That is loan by loan evaluation. And under the three bucket model, basically all originated loans would start in bucket one. Therefore, when entity has more than one loan contract, the timing of a transfer out of bucket one may differ on the basis of the timing of the origination of the loans. However, in practice, an entity monitors loans to the same borrower on an aggregated basis, given that it would be more appropriate to put all these loans in the same bucket. Therefore, one operational solution would be that once one of the loan is transferred out of bucket one, other loans to the same borrower should be also transferred out of bucket one at the same time. So that's my personal observations on this issue. And so I would appreciate it if you give us some views on this issue.
As I mentioned this earlier, I think, and when I talked about some of the operational challenges that entities face, and I think it depends how much the board would like to maintain that link between pricing and the determination of the losses, and if the board still maintains that objective, then it becomes an operational issue, but then we need to think about materiality and how an entity would be implementing this. And
I think basically we're aware of this issue.
Yeah.
But our objectives are different to the credit risk management objectives. We're trying to capture situations when there's been a deterioration, because we could have situations otherwise where you'd had a loan that was made several years ago to an entity that's now deteriorated and it's gone into lifetime losses, and now you're originating a new loan which could be at a much, much higher margin, and simply because the old loan had deteriorated, you'd start recognising a lifetime loss on that loan, and that's and that extreme example completely disconnected with what the board's trying to capture. So I think it's sort of, it's the most extreme example, which is why you're showing it, the most extreme example of how this approach, the deterioration approach, is different to a credit risk management's absolute view of the world. You know, they look at credit quality at this instant in time. We look at, has it deteriorated from what I priced?
Can I just ask about this? During our outreach, I think this has only come up in one meeting. I just wanted to get a feel for whether this would be a frequent occurrence, or does this issue come up often, or is it? Do you think it would be quite limited?
I don't think that's a rare case.
It's not a rare case.
But sometimes, for example, for non-financial institutions like the trading companies, they may provide some type of loans to one company, and also the other types of investment, like long-term loans, and also the short-term loans to support dairy business operations. So in that case, the objective of the loan are different from those two types of loans.
So one loan is the principal loan, and the second loan would be like for liquidity reasons to provide them with short-term cash.
From the viewpoint of credit risk monitoring, they are making an effort to maximize the total collection from those types of loans on aggregated basis. Regardless of whether which loan is primary or not. I think the OCHSA might be interested in that type of concerns, I think.
Thank you.
Can I jump in? It's actually, as Kamiya-san mentioned, it is not really rare case. Especially when you suffer a long-term depression or a long-term performing recession, then this case happens more. And if the recession prolonged, then the actually many entity goes into the non-performing status. Then perhaps this is not just a non-financial institution, but also banking industry as well. They would like to maximize the return. I mean, they minimize the loss. So in order to make, in order to minimize the total loss of the loans, they would dare to make a new loan without any large interest in order to support the lenders, not lenders,
borrowers.
So I don't know whether this is going to happen in other area of the world, but
Greece.
But I think this is where it becomes important to recognize the relationship between the interest and the loans, because if you're going into some extended recessionary period and all of the previous loans have gone into non-performing, if you put all of the new loans straight into non-performing as well and recognize lifetime loss for all your loans, that probably wouldn't reflect the economic reality, because you'll be not only even if you don't price for them, because you're trying to maximize the recovery of both loans.
Right.
So in aggregate, if you recognize lifetime losses for all your loans, you'll probably be understating the value of your assets. Whereas if you're recognizing lifetime losses for one and 12-month losses for the other, you may be
But this is a clear case where it demonstrates that you do need some deterioration.
I think so. Otherwise, everything would probably fall into lifetime losses, and that might not be economic.
I'm not supporting what Kamiya-san suggested, but what I think is important is we have to picture the total exposure to one borrower, and we have to have a kind of comprehensive assessment to one borrower. And it, of course, practically, it might be difficult, but...
it's tricky, though, because we account on an instrument-by-instrument basis. So we'd have to create some sort of exception for where you suddenly turn to some sort of portfolio view, which is inconsistent with the model of our whole financial instruments accounting.
We have 5 more minutes left before we have to move to our other meeting. Is there something that we can still do in those 5 minutes?
I think this is the final
issue for impairment. Okay. Any more comments on this? No? Okay, then we restart at what time?
Yes,
fine. Thank you. 1 o'clock? 1 o'clock, we start again. Yes, and then we will talk about leases, right? Another simple problem.